You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. On today's program, we're talking about the Green New Deal, a resolution before the U.S. Congress that directly addresses the climate change crisis. New Mexico Congresswoman Deborah Haaland, who is one of the two first Native American women elected to Congress, is holding a town hall this Thursday, the 18th of April at 7:30 in the evening right here in Santa Fe. We'll be talking to Congresswoman Haaland in just a moment. We'll also be talking to a young climate activist, Hannah Laga Abram, and we'll be talking to Craig O'Hare, who was a climate change activist before most of us were even aware that climate change was a problem. All of that is coming up in half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. It's my honor to welcome to the Radio Cafe Congresswoman Deborah Haaland. She's from New Mexico's 1st Congressional District. Congresswoman, tell us about why you signed on to the Green New Deal.
Because I believe that our country has to do our part regarding climate change. It's our responsibility to make sure that we are doing everything we can to ensure that we can leave a viable planet to our grandchildren, our generations to come. And at the rate we're going, every single day, there's a new article, no matter what publication you choose to read, about climate change. It's real. This is a turning point in our country's history. And I want to be on the correct side of our planet and our environment.
There's a lot of conversation about the cost of implementing some of the programs in the Green New Deal, how they're going to be so expensive, $1 trillion. Can you talk about the cost of not doing this and how you're thinking about that math?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, you know, they try to find an argument that they can poke holes in the fact that we have to do something about the amount of carbon that we're spewing into the atmosphere every single year. But look, you know, I am on the House Armed Services Committee, and already we've had several hearings on that issue, how climate change has ravaged military bases across our country. But it's happened everywhere else, too. And this is the problem, that vulnerable communities are the ones who get hit the hardest. Currently, there are people in Alaska who are planning, you know, they're trying to find ways to move entire villages because they're going to be underwater in 10 years. It's a reality that a lot of people face. It's expensive. Climate change, you know, I think about what if we had started worrying about this 50 years ago, that we'd be in a much better place. And things, yes, they would be cheaper. But it's expensive if we do nothing. It's expensive if we do something, so we might as well do something.
How are Native communities in New Mexico and other states responding to the Green New Deal?
Well, I think that there are a large number of Native folks who are on board. You know, part of this, I guess, this new era where so many more people than ever before are thinking about climate change in a different way and advocating for our part in remedying the situation. I went to Standing Rock in 2016 and stood with the water protectors. And, you know, it's about us protecting our earth. Standing Rock to me was a turning point in and of itself because I felt like a lot of tribes came together to support them. Right now, there are other Indian tribes who are fighting pipelines in their areas. You probably know about Winona LaDuke, who has been fighting a pipeline in her native lands in Minnesota, you know, threatening to destroy their ancient rice beds. We all have to support one another in this issue, and I believe that Indian tribes for them, it's a cultural thing. We owe it to our ancestors to protect our sacred sites. And I think that's maybe what's a little bit different than some of the other ways people are thinking about it.
What about the rest of your constituents in New Mexico? You are from the First District, a lot of people in Albuquerque and that area. How are they responding to the Green New Deal? Have you been hearing from people?
Yes, we hear from them nearly every day. I already had a Green New Deal town hall in Albuquerque. It was sold out. It was very, very well attended. I had a group of kids join me who are right there side by side working to combat this issue. You know, we realized not only the need for us to fight climate change, but also the benefits that moving toward renewable energy would have for our communities, right? It could create thousands and thousands of jobs. So I think people recognize that it's not only, you know, fighting a very destructive force, but it's also bringing in a new era of economic opportunity for many, many people. And so that's another thing that I think that we should also be focusing on.
There's a sense of denial on the other side of the aisle that we even have basically this huge existential problem. It's like a giant monster is coming to ravage the city and they're really not paying attention. And part of that, I think, is about people thinking in the short term. They're thinking about quarterly reports and profits. They're thinking about 2-year and 4-year election cycles. How do you think that government and business can engage in more realistic long-term thinking?
Well, at this juncture, I'm surprised that anyone is in denial about climate change because the science does not support that idea. The science is clear, right? The science is clear that climate change is happening. And so I feel like the other side of the aisle is kind of their last-ditch effort to get folks to support the fossil fuel industry, get people to support the idea that climate change isn't happening. I just don't, you know, I don't think they're going to be able to do that for very much longer. And I also feel like the support for our world, not just our country, but our entire world, making the changes that we need is extremely strong right now. And, you know, I'm the vice chair of the National Park, Forest, and Public Land Subcommittee on the Natural Resources Committee. And I'm also the vice chair of the full committee on natural resources. And the first 3 hearings we had during this Congress were all on climate change. They hadn't had a climate change hearing in 10 years. So we have had hearing after hearing on climate change. And, you know, our public lands are so connected to that issue. Right now, public lands are responsible for something like 25% of carbon emissions in this country. So we have work to do to curb those. You know, the budget plan for the national parks and the Bureau of Land Management, it needs to be that they are working toward finding solutions to that horrible, you know, rate that they currently have right now. So we're raising the issue. We're pushing them toward finding solutions to that. It's clear we have to do something. So I think the consensus with the majority in the House is that everybody's talking about this issue. Everybody cares about it. We're all going to work toward finding a way to make it a reality.
What it looks like from the outside, I mean, I'm sitting here in New Mexico, but what it looks like is that the so-called conservatives, which is a word I don't even know what it means anymore because I'm not really sure what they're conserving, but they've been able to take control of the conversation and set the terms of the debate for a very long time, despite not having morality or fiscal restraint or science on their side. How is the Democratic Party as a whole addressing the challenge of taking more control of the conversation, if they are?
Right. No, I think we have taken control of the conversation. You know, I'm one of the first 2 Native American women to win a seat in Congress. For 200 plus years, we'd never had a Native woman in Congress. I ran on fighting climate change, creating a renewable energy economy, healthcare, public education, and then of course I'm very good on many, many other issues. But climate change and renewable energy were my top two issues for my entire campaign. I got elected because of my stance on those issues. People like Joe Neguse in Boulder, Colorado, he got elected because his stance on climate change and renewable energy. So did Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, right? There's so many of us freshmen who are in Congress right now. We got elected because we said we would defend our environment and that we would fight climate change and move our country forward toward renewable energy. I think that's grabbing a hold of the conversation. And we're in the majority now. All of us are working extremely hard to stay true to the promises that we made during our campaigns with respect to bringing attention to the issue, fighting to make sure that we are doing something about it. And I feel very confident that the other side, they're losing on the messaging right now.
Congresswoman Deborah Haaland from New Mexico's 1st District, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you at the town hall.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with an extraordinary youth activist named Hannah Laga Abram. The Santa Fe Institute's Community Lecture Series brings leading thinkers to Santa Fe to explore profound questions. Why do some societies enforce monogamous marriage while the majority allow polygyny? How does inheritance vary from one society to the next? Tuesday, April 16th at 7:30 p.m., anthropologist Laura Fortunato will discuss how human social behavior evolves. Reserve your free seat at ticketssantafe.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Hannah Laga Abram. She's a senior at the Waldorf School, and she's working with the Sunrise Movement, which is a national youth-driven movement working on climate change and social justice. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you, and it's really important to hear youth voices speaking up on both climate change and all the social justice and economic justice movements that we're facing in this country. How did you get involved with this? How are you thinking about this movement right now? What's your own participation?
Yeah, I feel like I've been involved for as long as I can remember. Both of my parents are very environmentally aware, and I've been lucky enough to sort of have grown up in the, you know, mountains around Santa Fe, which has been wonderful. And so just falling in love with the wilderness, but specifically with the Sunrise Movement and youth activism. Last spring, I sort of started and co-founded a youth advocacy group in Santa Fe. We're called the Student Advocacy Union New Mexico. And we sort of grew out of the March for Our Lives movement. A bunch of students from different high schools coming together very serendipitously and starting to organize because we felt like New Mexico gun laws were very, very lacking. And after we organized this amazing event last year at the Roundhouse, we realized we actually could do something, you know, that started conversations and that changed people's minds. And there are so many issues in, you know, in the world, in this country, and especially in this state, that really require youth input. And so we started meeting on a weekly basis, and we work on several different issues. But then a few months ago, I got in touch with the Sunrise Movement, and they're a movement who gives me personally a lot of hope. I mean, for me, climate change is the biggest issue, and the Sunrise Movement is the only movement I've encountered so far who are really willing to look at the scale of the crisis and think about practical solutions, even if they have to be incredibly radical and unprecedented. But that is the time that we're living in. And so got in touch with them and have sort of been working with them since then. We presented the resolution for the federal Green New Deal to the city council and have been in touch with them since. And I also organized the climate strike on March 15th here in Santa Fe. So it's an ongoing process, and that's what it needs to be.
What are some of the big solutions that you're most excited about?
I want to be careful with the word solution, because I think this isn't a problem that we can just solve right away. What we need right now is huge cultural change. And I don't think that I've seen any solutions that are really going to fix it. What I have seen from the Sunrise Movement and from the Green New Deal is a willingness to start talking about what's going on and a willingness for immediate action. And what I'm really and truly most excited about with the Green New Deal is the just very clear need to cut carbon emissions to zero, you know, as soon as we possibly can, and to do that in a way that is just for our frontline and impacted communities, and to take leadership from those who actually still have some inkling of what it might mean to have a real reciprocal relationship with the earth. So I think that that's really important.
When you talk about cultural change, what do you think that looks like?
I don't completely know. I wish I did. I wish I had a clear sort of plan laid out, but I don't. What I do think is that climate change isn't just an effect of us burning carbon fuels and fossil fuels. It's an effect also of our capitalist system and our growth economy, which refuses to stop at anything. It's an effect of the patriarchy and white supremacy and all these social systems that we have set in place that focus on really lessening the people they oppress, and in so doing also oppressing the earth and the relationship with the earth. And somehow, and I don't know if this is possible, we need to get back to a place where we are humble, where we honor and respect one another and the earth, and where we're careful about what we say and how we work and of the impact that everything we do has on our surroundings. We need to remember that we're actually part of this place, as opposed to just aliens who were placed here and who now get to exploit it. So I think it's a mindset change.
Yeah. You're in high school. Talk about what the feeling is like among high school students in your school, in the city of Santa Fe and beyond, whom you've encountered. Do you feel like most people are on the same page with the way you've been talking about this?
Yes and no. I think that I've thought about this a lot, so I'm able to, you know, sit here and speak with you in a fairly collected way. Most of my peers are in this place of intense frustration and anger, which I also feel super intensely. And we're scared. We're terrified. You know, we want a chance to live in this gorgeous place. And yet we're now having to deal with the fact that it's on the brink, or even over the brink, of complete and utter disaster. So we're scared. We're so angry that even though these statistics have been out, nothing has really changed in the last 30 years, even though, granted, many people have made an effort, but it's never been enough. You know, we should all be out on the streets every day right now, but it's so hard to step out of the system. And so I think we also hold a great deal of frustration of, like, how do we fight this fight well and speak in a way that the lawmakers and policymakers and people in charge are actually going to listen to us? And still, you know, how do we do that, but also boycott this system that is so difficult? You know, I've been having to sort of balance and play between, you know, being an activist and being a high schooler and having homework and applying to colleges and all of these things that seem so much smaller in comparison, but that are made to take up so much of our time and that are made out to be so important. And I am really excited about college, and I am really looking forward to getting to study what I want, but there's so much confusion and frustration among the youth of how do we deal with this? It's such an obvious and such a clear issue, and yet we're so stuck in this economic growth sort of success system.
Right, right. Will you be at the town hall?
I will, yeah.
Well, Hanna Laga Abram, we look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for taking time during a break in your school day today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me and for talking about this really important issue. I very much appreciate it.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in half a minute. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the LANL Foundation for their support. I'm very happy now to welcome Craig O'Hare. He is a longtime climate change activist, a longtime environmental activist. He is a volunteer with the Sunrise Movement, the national youth-driven movement, working on climate change and social justice. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be here.
So we are talking about the Green New Deal and the upcoming town hall in which Congresswoman Deborah Holland will be talking about it and inviting public participation here in Santa Fe. Give us a little overview of the Green New Deal. It's not very long. It's not a comprehensive legal document. It is more like a resolution saying, here's the problem.
That's right. It's really a vision statement, if you will, that has three main components. The first is to try to address and prevent catastrophic climate change by getting our government, our country, on a path of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And the other two legs of the stool are all about economic justice and social justice. That when we're going to make this huge economic and environmental transition away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy and energy efficiency, that we do it in a way that's respectful to disadvantaged populations, indigenous populations, that we do it with a real eye toward social justice. The Green New Deal has actually been introduced as a resolution in Congress. It's House Resolution 109, introduced by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York and by Senator Markey out of Massachusetts. And it's a resolution that has that goal. It has a goal of basically cutting our greenhouse gas emissions as a country by the year 2030 and becoming completely carbon neutral by 2050.
There is a great disconnect between the truth of the material that's in the New Deal. For example, I'm just reading from the Green New Deal. Global warming at or above 2 degrees Celsius beyond pre-industrial levels will cause mass migration for those affected to the regions affected most by climate change, a $500 billion loss of annual economic output in the United States by the year 2100, wildfires, loss of coral reefs, and so on and so on. There is such a disconnect between that and the political and business reality that we have in our country. How are you thinking about that? I mean, the thing that I keep wondering about is, do we have to go into utter economic and social collapse before the people in power see the light?
It's an excellent question. I certainly hope we don't have to go to economic and social collapse. That's really the $64,000 question, is how do we take an existing economic structure that we have that's obviously driven by capitalism, and capitalism, for better or for worse, unfortunately doesn't know how to look after the future and the well-being of future generations. Capitalism is very myopic. And so really what the Green New Deal about is saying, we're going to have to change the paradigm about how capitalism works. It's no longer going to be sufficient to just deliver energy as cheaply as possible, but we're going to have to look at what's sustainable and what can our globe's climate tolerate over the long run. But you're bringing up the biggest challenge, which is politically, this is still, unfortunately, a very huge uphill battle to try to change the mindset, if you will, and get people to start thinking about, gee, what sort of world are we handing our children? Are we handing our children a planet whose climate is so wounded that they're going to have a hard time enjoying life the way we've been able to.
You've been working on this a long time, and you were actually one of the early climate change activists before climate change, climate disruption, global warming, and so on were even really terms that people were using. How did you get into that?
Yeah, so I've been an environmental activist pretty much my whole life, and got involved active in college. And then I got involved with the Sierra Club in Arizona during the 1980s. And then I became the state conservation chair for the Sierra Club in Arizona, and started to become a climate change activist, because there was plenty of information 30 years ago that climate change was happening, that there was a concern. And so I was working on it before the, if you remember, the Kyoto Protocol that came out in, I think it was 1992. Yeah, I was involved for probably 15 years aggressively fighting climate change.
So you were doing this in the 1980s, the 1990s.
Yeah.
Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, came out in the middle of the first decade of the 21st century.
Right.
In the time before An Inconvenient Truth, what was it like to try to be getting this message out?
It was really challenging. It was actually during a time when the Republicans were even more receptive to talking about climate change than they are now. I was in Arizona. I worked with Senator John McCain on at the time it was called a cap and trade bill that was all about climate change. It's probably not the most effective way to make it happen, but it was during a time when there were at least some moderate Republicans that were willing to take a look at it and say, yeah, this really is a problem. And we're struggling to find that these days, unfortunately.
One of the things that I think is interesting, and it's another part of the disconnect, is that the Pentagon is acknowledging climate change.
Exactly.
Insurance companies are acknowledging climate change. Different branches of the military, different branches that are doing economic forecasting, both in the public and the private sectors, they're all acknowledging climate change. And yet there's one party that isn't.
It really is kind of interesting, because you're right. Just recently, the Department of Defense came out with a report and basically said that climate change is one of the three top threats to the United States security and stability, if you will, facing us. So here we have our own military saying, A, climate change is real, and B, we want to talk about migration of peoples and dislocations, that climate change could be the most disrupting influence on our nation's stability that we've maybe even ever seen. And what's really interesting, Mary Charlotte, is you're probably aware of the flooding that's been going on in the Midwest from the, I forget what it was called, the super bomb storm or the bomb cyclone frozen thing or something. But anyhow, it's like a lot of the Midwest has been underwater for the last 6 weeks. As we speak, there's another storm hitting the Midwest, and you're starting to see a number of Republican mayors of small towns in the Midwest say, climate change is real. We are getting hammered by climate change.
Right. So we may be in the middle of a shift, and then the question of whether it's too little too late is on a lot of people's minds as well.
That's right. And I think we don't know for certain if it's too little or too late. The International Panel on Climate Change report that came out last fall, that's overseen by the United Nations, suggested that hopefully we still have time to prevent the most severe impacts of catastrophic climate change. Obviously, we're already starting to see the impacts right now. So hopefully we still do have time. And that's the whole notion of the we must reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the year 2030 is the climate scientists believe that there's a really good chance that if we're actually able to make that reduction, and that is obviously a huge reduction since we've only been going up with greenhouse gases in the last 30 years, that we actually may have indeed a good possibility that we will prevent the worst of climate change. But we don't know for sure, absolutely, but it's something where instead of just throwing our hands up and giving up and saying it's too late, I think it's really important for all of us to do what we can. And really, the really most promising aspect of this right now, the Green New Deal, Mary Charlotte, is that, as Hannah, your youth speaker, has recognized, this is a really big youth movement. For the very first time, we're having the kids of America, and frankly, the kids from around the world. We've got Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist, 16-year-old, and they're the ones turning around to the adults and their parents saying, I can't tolerate this. You are handing me an unlivable world, and this is unacceptable. And I think that's really promising as far as maybe we can get somewhere with that message from our globe's youth.
A very hopeful movement indeed. Craig O'Hare, just talk for a moment about the upcoming town hall with Congresswoman Deborah Haaland. What's it all about? Why should people show up?
Well, people should show up because they're concerned about catastrophic global climate change. We really want to have a kind of a laser focus on the Green New Deal and the importance of our congressional delegation endorsing and signing on to the Green New Deal. We're very, very ecstatic that Congresswoman Deb Haaland has signed on. She's shown great leadership in that area. The town hall is this coming Thursday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Center for Progress and Justice. That's where the Democratic Party meets, but this is open to all political persuasions. And that's at 1420 Cerrillos Road.
Right here in Santa Fe.
Right here in Santa Fe.
Craig O'Hare, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.